Welcome to Wall Street Unspun with your host, Peter Schiff.
But it's a giant bubble in search of a pin, and it's going
to
find one.
Are you confused with the ups and downs of the economy and what it means to you?
Don't believe the propaganda, and that's what it is. When you're listening to an analyst on a lot of these popular financial shows, you're not getting investment advice. You're getting propaganda.
Get ready to untangle the web of misinformation provided by the mainstream media.
These firms are trying to sell you stocks. Their real clients, their banking clients, are trying to get rid of stuff.
And now, here's your host of Wall Street Unspun, the president of Euro Pacific Capital and a licensed broker with a passion for truth. It's Wall Street Unspun with Peter Schiff.
Hi, everybody. Again, welcome to a live episode of Wall Street Unspun. I do this show every Wednesday when I remember, which is most of the time. Live at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, 5 p.m. Pacific. We are simulcasting on shortwave radio, 5.07 megahertz, and on my website at www.europac.net. The number to call toll-free to get in on the discussion, 888-678-9597, 888-678-9597. The number to call. The lines are open. First of all, apologize for last week. If anybody tuned in to listen to the program, I wasn't in. I totally forgot about it. Now, I was in Las Vegas for the Money Show. I did have a workshop on Wednesday evening, but I think I was able to do the show and just whatever, you know, as I was there, I just forgot about doing it. And I didn't even realize that I didn't do the show until I got an email, I think yesterday, somebody was saying, hey, where's the show? Why isn't it up, why isn't the new show up on the internet? And it wasn't until then, almost a week later, that it hit me that I totally forgot to do the radio show. And so I think what they did is they played just an older show. So if anybody listened to last week, you weren't hearing a live show. You were just hearing a replay of an earlier show that I had done. But hopefully I won't forget. I think the people over that do the show didn't have even, I think, my cell phone number, because if they would have called me, I mean, I might have been able to quickly come to the phone. But I had no idea that I was even missing the show. It's amazing. You know, you change your routine a little bit, and I just forget what was going on. Anyway, with the Money Show was good. If anybody was at the Money Show, it'd be a good opportunity to call the program and talk about your experience. And if you want to see me in Las Vegas, I will be there again. I sent out an email to everybody for Mark Skousen's Freedom Fest, which is July 4th in Las Vegas. Quite a bit hotter, but if you don't mind that, there should be a lot of interesting speakers, many more interesting speakers, I think, gathered in that small conference than were at the Money Show. Interesting thing, though, in the bull bear debate that we had at the Money Show, it was a lot more civil. You know, Louis Navalier, wasn't yelling at me, and neither was Joe Battipaglia. In fact, they were almost in agreement, not in that they were bearish on the U.S., but they all really liked the foreign markets and exposure overseas and acknowledged that those markets have been doing better, which has always been my point in these bull bear debates, was that regardless of what you think, you're better off being invested abroad. Even if you don't understand and comprehend the serious problems facing our country, you can still see that the returns abroad are better than the returns here. And so you don't necessarily have to understand these problems and be the gloom and doom, doomer that I am, to appreciate the benefits of global investing. You know, regardless of your outlook for the U.S., it's pretty clear, and it's becoming clearer every day, that the opportunities abroad are much better, both for dividends and for appreciation. And there's an appreciation of the fact that regardless of what people think about the U.S. economy, the dollar is likely to decline. And so if the dollar is going to decline, I mean, that only increases the returns abroad relative to the returns in the United States. Anyway, up on my website, I usually don't know about these TV appearances too far in advance, but I agreed to do Kudlow and Company on CNBC a week from Friday. They actually wanted to have me on last Friday, but they called, you know, that morning, and I couldn't make it because I was flying home from Las Vegas. But they booked me for not this Friday, but a week from Friday. So you got plenty of advanced notice if you want to set a VCR or, you know, have a chance to watch it live, because it is in the evenings. You know, it's, I think it's 5 o'clock, fighting from 5 to 6 p.m. Eastern time on the East Coast. Yeah, so that's 2 to 3 on the West Coast, so it happens kind of midday. But I'm not really sure what the topic is going to be. I do know that Larry Kudlow will not be there. Almost every time I do the Kudlow show, Kudlow's away. I mean, I've done it with him there, but you know, a lot of times they tend to book me when he's not in town. But you know, at first I thought maybe he was ducking me. But you know, if I would have been able to make a Friday show, he would have been there. Anyway, and if there it's a chance that there might be some other appearances before then, and if there are any other ones, I will put them up on my website or potentially mention them next week if they're going to be Thursday. Anyway, you know, the markets around the world continue to make new highs. I mean, the Dow made a new intraday high today and finally went down a little bit. They're blaming the decline on Alan Greenspan, who made comments about the Chinese market, saying that it's overvalued and due to come down. I mean, duh. And I don't know, you know, why is it any different if Greenspan says it? I mean, it's just his opinion. It's, you know, I mean, he made his irrational exuberance speech in 1996, and look how much higher the stock market went before it finally broke. So I don't know why people are going to make stock market decisions based on a comment that Alan Greenspan happens to make about what he thinks about the value of a particular market. That's never really, market timing has never really been his forte. And there are a lot of things that haven't been his forte. So I don't know that it really had anything to do with what Greenspan said, but we did surrender the rally today, and we ended up with some marginal declines. But, yeah, I think there's no doubt in my mind that Chinese stocks are expensive. And they're probably going to get more expensive. I mean, we're not really buying mainland Chinese stocks. And, you know, these stocks are trading 30, 40, 50 times earnings right now. So I don't think there's value there. I think it's much better to get exposure to the Chinese market through Hong Kong. The valuations are much, much better over there. So that's the best way to go about it. And there are a lot of stocks that we are recommending in the Hong Kong market that give you exposure to China without, you know, having to pay nosebleed valuations for stocks that, you know, could really fall precipitously at any minute. And I think that's likely to happen. But if anything, it's reminiscent of the 1920s and what happened in the United States. And again, I've mentioned this comparison before, but I've even used it with Japan. But perhaps it's even more apropos with China, where China is rapidly increasing its money supply in order to prevent the U.S. dollar from collapsing. And the money that it is creating is going into the stock market, producing a speculative bubble. That's very similar to what we did in the 1920s in order to prop up the British pound. We were very easy, and we blew up a stock market bubble. The patterns are even more similar when you look at the relative economic positions of the nations involved. Whereas in the 1930s or 1920s, Britain was the declining power, and we were the emerging power. And today, the same situation with different players, where China is the emerging power and we are the declining power. So it's very similar. And I do think at some point we will see a big drop in the Chinese market, probably coinciding with a big drop in the U.S. dollar and a rise in their currency. In fact, you know, they have these high-profile meetings going on right now, trade meetings. I think something like half of the Chinese cabinet is in Washington. And, of course, it's all a lot of demagoguery on our part, where American politicians are standing up and criticizing China, saying that China is responsible for the loss of our manufacturing jobs, that China is responsible for, you know, a lot of problems in the U.S. economy. And this is nonsense. We're responsible for these problems. You know, our problem is that we don't save enough and we don't produce enough. We're spending too much. You know, I mean, that's not the fault of the Chinese. Now, sure, by artificially propping up our currency, they are acting as an enabler, and it's making it easier for us to do the wrong thing. And if the Chinese acted, you know, a little bit differently, then we couldn't get ourselves into the mess that we're in. But it's still not their fault. It's not their fault that we're not producing. It's not their fault that we're not saving. It's not their fault that we're taxing and regulating our businesses so much as to make them uncompetitive. That's our fault. Now, the fact of the matter is that it's amazing that we're going to try to browbeat the Chinese when all that's standing between us and, you know, and a depression are the Chinese. You know, the Chinese have been the biggest buyers of our bonds and the biggest suppliers of our consumer goods, which means the Chinese are simultaneously keeping prices down and interest rates down. And that's what's really sustaining this whole, you know, bubble economy. And so to be critical of the Chinese and to try to blame them for our problems and try to, you know, demand that they cease what they're doing is very, very dangerous territory upon which, you know, American politicians are treading. And we'll have to see what happens. But I did read some articles and some quotes in Chinese papers, and it certainly shows that the Chinese seem to get it, you know, that these are American-made problems, and they have to do with, you know, our own inadequate savings in production and not anything that they're doing. But it's interesting to see what's going to come out of these meetings. But it's interesting, you know, what we've seen over the last week is major high-profile purchases. You know, the Chinese government, it took an 8% stake for $3 billion in Blackstone. They're a private equity fund that's going to be going public shortly. And that's a huge investment. Also, a Saudi Arabian company, I think in the last week or so, agreed to spend about $12 billion buying out the plastic division of General Electric. That's a huge acquisition. Again, this is the flip side of the trade deficit, where we are sending dollars to the world to consume, and those dollars, the world ends up using those dollars to take away our assets. You know, we are, you know, hawking these assets. We're selling off our cows to import milk. And this is, it's amazing how little angst there is in the media about, you know, key assets, you know, moving away from American control and ownership to foreign ownership. Also, interesting event that happened recently, I think it was in the last week, was that the Kuwaiti government has abandoned its dollar peg. And, you know, I mean, this is a country that, you know, if it wasn't for the United States, Kuwait might not even be here. I mean, we had to go down there and kick Saddam Hussein, you know, out of Kuwait. Yet they're abandoning the dollar peg. And this is a negative thing for the U.S. Although, you know, on the surface, here we are, you know, trying to browbeat the Chinese into dropping their peg. So, you know, what does that say that we, you know, we would try to convince the Kuwaitis that they need to keep a peg when we want the Chinese to abandon theirs? But the net effect is that means that the Kuwaiti governments will not have to buy as many dollars because they won't need to artificially suppress their currency. And so, you know, it's just a big negative. And as more and more countries around the world who do use the dollar in some fashion move away from it, it just further undermines demand for the dollar. And again, we're not putting any real demand out there because we're not producing the products that people need dollars to buy. So when other financial reasons, when people start to wake up to reality of what's going on, that's a big negative. Anyway, we've got a couple of people who have been waiting on hold, so let's go to the phones. First, we've got Angela from Florida. Go ahead. Hello, is Angela there?
Our problem is that we don't save enough.
Yes, I am.
We're spending too much.
Hello?
Yeah, Angela?
Yes, I'm here.
Yes, you're on the air with Peter Schiff.
Oh, I'm listening to your show and I wasn't on. So.
Well, you got to turn off. There's a delay, but turn down the radio.
Okay. I have been a client since about November, and I'm real pleased with what my stocks are doing and funds. I had some questions. One thing I'm not real pleased with is that Net Exchange, trying to look at stocks, it's not very accessible sometimes.
You're talking about the access online to your account?
Yeah, and it just seems kind of slow. I wish that could get speeded up somehow to see.
I don't know. Is that I don't know. Is it, what kind of computer are you using? I mean, is it slow for other things?
Pretty good one. You know, somewhat newer HP Pavilion laptop. And it's not that. I mean, it's like when funds get sold and stuff, I guess it just seems to take a few days to see anything. And it also seems to, I know I've got a Toronto stock, but it's showing the American ADR, and I don't know if it's tracking that as the numbers.
It wouldn't show the ADR unless you owned the ADR, but the way our statements work in our accounts is that all the stocks, you know, have over-the-counter symbols, and when they put them in your account, they reference them using the over-the-counter symbol.
Okay.
Usually a five-letter symbol ending in an F.
Yeah.
And so that even if you see that five-letter over-the-counter symbol, we're not trading them over-the-counter. We're trading them, you know, in their local market. So
okay. It's
a little bit deceptive when the way they do that. But they have to do that in order to get the dollar pricing because it's a dollar statement.
Okay, but it's
showing
that ADR
symbol. No, it's not an ADR.
I mean OTC price or whatever the F.
Yeah, but yeah, they might be picking up an OTC price. Technically, they're not supposed to. They're supposed to pick up the actual foreign price statements. And most of the time they do.
Okay.
But sometimes it's a little bit inaccurate.
Okay. Well, yeah, because I just have to go. I've got my.
Unless it says, you know, ADR, it's not an ADR.
Okay. Next thing was I was listening to your talk on China and agree with what you're saying. And, I think Greenspan was coming on board after several other people are saying that there's going to be a sizable drop in the China market. And I was wondering if you think you have any reason to believe that's going to happen. They're just going to
come. Well, the market's very expensive, and it's moved up so far so fast. There's no question that the Chinese market is going to have a sharp correction. What the real question is when and then what, you know. I mean, is it going to drop 20% and then make new highs? Or is it going to drop? I mean, it's obvious at some point the market's going to have a sharp decline.
Huh?
Isn't so obvious is then what happens?
Yeah, I mean,
I still think that most Chinese stocks are expensive, but I do think that in terms of dollars, I think when we really have a really big decline in Chinese stocks, at the same time, you'll have a big increase in the value of their money.
Okay.
So that from a dollar perspective, the share prices will probably be rising, even though that from a Chinese perspective, they'll be falling.
Okay.
The Chinese won't be worse off, because if their currency goes up by more than the value of their, the price of their stocks declines, even though they have less yuan, the yuan they have left buy them more things.
Mm.
And that's what's important. The important thing is purchasing power. It's not important how many dollars somebody has or how many euros or how many Chinese yuan. What's important is what they buy. And, you know, there are plenty of billionaires now in Zimbabwe, but having a billion Zimbabwe dollars doesn't mean very much.
Yeah.
So when it comes to paper money, just quantities, you know, conveys very little. And, from, you know, it's what you can buy. And even if the Chinese market goes down 90% at some point, but the dollar goes down 95%, then they still have twice the purchasing power. Even though they have fewer quantity of a currency, they can buy more things because prices will actually fall. See, it won't just be stock prices that will fall, but the price of oil will fall, the price of meat will fall, the price of, you know, other commodities will come down for them.
Well, so what about my stocks? And I've got I've got three or four in Hong Kong or Shanghai, and
we're probably buying in Hong Kong, but yeah, we're not buying the stocks that are at nosebleed valuations. We're buying more basic businesses. But yeah, I mean, if the Chinese market really gets clobbered, probably almost all the stocks that we own for our clients will go down too. It's just my thought that they won't go down as much.
Hmm.
In the meantime, we're collecting very high dividends, and we don't know when they're going to go down. And in general, I think we're better off owning assets than paper.
So it's not worth dumping out of those for a while until it...
No, because we don't know exactly what's going to happen.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, we can think that the markets are going to go down. We can step aside, and they can go up another 20 or 30%. Then what do we do?
Yeah.
I would rather just have...
In there.
...fully invested in defensive-oriented, high-yielding stocks and not worry about when they might have a significant pullback. Because it really doesn't matter to our long-term objectives for the accounts, and it shouldn't impact the dividends.
Well, I've got two of them in stocks that you hadn't recommended, but they seem like good companies, like Vitasoy you did. I guess some food companies, I guess they still have to sell food to people. there, and it's mostly selling in China. So,
yeah, well, there's a lot of food. We've been doing some interesting, you know, food and beverage companies, and you know, I like basic, you know, basic businesses. You know,
yeah.
You know, like, you know, we own a lot of property trusts, and you know, the reason I like them is, you know, I mean, they're commercial property, but you know, when was the last time somebody ever lowered your rent? You know, I mean, I like to own businesses where the earnings always go up, and when you're a landlord, you pretty much your earnings go up because you raise rents. I mean, rents don't go down; they go up.
Yeah.
So as people are able to raise their rent, they're able to raise my dividend. And I'd rather own something like that. You know, utility rates don't go down; they go up. And so, you know, these are companies that are going to consistently grow their earnings and be able to pay us bigger dividends. And sure, there could be some fluctuation in their share price based on some, you know, extreme market event.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, as long as, you know, we're not highly leveraged, which our clients are not,
mm-hmm.
no reason to fear one of these events. It might temporarily suppress the value of our stocks if we need to sell. But in the long run, it should do nothing to diminish the value of our stocks. And it should do nothing in the short run even to diminish our dividends, which is the more important thing right now.
Okay. I've got just a couple others, and should be pretty quick. I just ran into a situation with that ABG Sundial that they gave a dividend, but they held back some taxes.
Well, yeah, I mean, again,
that money, do I just...
Too much about individual stocks on the show.
Yeah.
But
I mean, just
all the countries that we invest in, pretty much there is a withholding from the government,
mm-hmm.
based on a portion of your dividend is withheld,
mm-hmm.
and you know that's just the way the world works.
Do I need to do anything with country with the taxes?
Well, what you need to do is when you file your U.S. taxes, you can claim your tax credit.
Okay.
Taxes. That's what you need to do. You just need to talk to one of your accountants. But also, you could talk to the representative you're working with if you're mm-hmm. Pacific Capital. It's kind of a boring conversation for the radio.
Okay.
But it's something that you can talk to. But it's important that people remember to take these foreign tax credits when they're available, because otherwise you're just giving money away.
Okay. My last one, what do you think, is cobalt and nickel going to keep going up? Because I was looking at it.
I think nickel looks great. I think it's, you know, I mean, you know, one of the best investments right now are nickels, U.S. nickels. The nickels in circulation now, you know, I think have a face value, a melt value of more than twice, you know, they're worth more than a dime.
Wow.
Metal on them. So you can't lose, you know. All you can lose is, you know, you have to store them. But if you have a nickel, it's actually worth more than a dime. And no matter what happens to the price of nickel, it'll never be worth less than a nickel. So, you know, if you have them, you can't lose.
And cobalt, which is...
Thanks for the... I don't really know much about cobalt, but pretty much most metals are going up. So, you know.
Okay.
Whatever it is, it's going higher. All right, thanks for the call.
All right, thanks a lot.
All right, let me quickly pause, take a break. I've only got one caller on hold. I will take that call after the break. Anybody else who might want to call, the number is 888-678-9597, 888-678-9597.
Euro Pacific Capital is an independent brokerage firm on a mission to inform its client base and prospective clients about economic and market events that could affect their financial security. Euro Pacific Capital seeks to provide solutions which are intended to provide safety, not risk. Solutions designed to protect our clients and their families from the U.S. government and its inflationary practices. The time to act is now, while you still have the opportunity to get your money out of the dollar. It's legal to do so, and after a consultation with one of Euro-Pacific's brokers, you will understand how this decision could ensure your financial security. We offer a full array of services ranging from retirement and trust accounts to complete financial planning, checking accounts with or without debit cards, and life insurance, even annuities. With our independent, no-nonsense investment advice that's a cut above the run-of-the-mill commentary that is passed for research for far too long on Wall Street, we suspect investors will find a home at Euro Pacific Capital.
Okay, we are back. Again, 888-678-9597, the number to call. And we have one more caller hanging on, Stan from Florida. Go ahead, Stan.
Hey, how are you doing, Peter?
I'm okay. How are you?
Pretty good. I had a question, and I wondered what your feelings are about the long-term outlook of the Australian dollar. I'm looking to hold some short-term cash, and one of the things I found an online checking where you can actually convert your U.S. dollars into foreign currency. I don't plan on holding large sums, but for some type of emergency fund, would Australian dollars be a good choice as far as currency?
Yeah, you know, the Australian dollar looks good to me on a chart. I mean, the Canadian dollar actually broke out to a 30-year high this week. It's the only currency that's really made new highs this week. It's up over 92 cents. So that looks pretty good. But I like the look of the Australian dollar. But for short term, right, you're talking about short term, anything could happen. Hell, the dollar could rally 5 or 10%. I mean, anything could happen in the short run. We don't know for sure.
Well, I'm talking about for my short-term cash, like holding between maybe, say, $6,000 to $7,000 for my sake or for someone else's sake in, you know, just emergency funds if you, you know, something bad were to happen, you know. I guess my question was, you know, is the Australian dollar a good currency?
I mean, I think it's good. I mean, we have a lot of money in Australia. I mean, I prefer Australian equities because, you know, central banks around the world are printing too much money. Australia is no exception. Everybody is creating money too fast for my taste, and so therefore I'm not enamored by any currency, okay? But, you know, so it's a question of, you know, which currencies are likely to lose the most value. And, you know, there the dollar is the hands-down winner. So I want to have assets denominated in other currencies, but I'd rather have assets than paper. I'd rather own the real stuff because we're living in such a highly inflationary time period. And the question is, how much longer is this inflationary period going to last before central banks do the right thing? I don't know. It could be years and years. So I'd just rather own stuff. But again, I don't want to be overexposed to, you know, high momentum, high PE, high beta stocks. I just want to own the basic, you know, defensive widows and orphans type stocks so that I have protection against inflation, but I'm not too highly exposed if these central banks do the right thing and, you know, dramatically hike interest rates and reduce the growth of money supply and cause major declines in stock markets around the world.
Let me rephrase the question, because most of the stuff I do own is assets, but I think everybody, you know, likes to have some liquidity, you know, being able to, you know, draw from a checking account or something like that. And I guess the question is, long term, do you see the Australian dollar as one of the better currencies?
Well, long term, yeah, long term I think it's going higher, but you're talking short term and you never know. But yeah, sure, long term it's going up, you know, I think there's no doubt about that.
And I'll let you with this last question. How would you rate it as far as other currencies in the world?
One to own. I mean, you know, we don't own. I take a position that it makes sense to own a basket of currencies. You know, we never know because it's all politicians. You know, who are you going to trust? You know, all these currencies are fiat. Nothing's backed by anything. So it's, you know, you just got to cover your bases. And I just believe in having assets in several of the world's major currencies that look to be in less trouble than the dollar.
Yeah.
And just own those, you know, and just that's just the way to go.
All right. Okay, thanks.
Thanks for the call. We've got another caller on the line, Ken, from New York.
Hi, Peter. How are you doing?
Okay, how are you?
Okay, I was wondering. I've been talking to a guy who travels a lot. He goes to China and Taiwan. I was wondering what your take on investing in Taiwan and its currency and your relationship with China. He says the people.
Well, you know, the Taiwan, you know, we don't do a lot of investing in Taiwan because it's difficult for Americans to invest over there. There are controls. So there are a few markets in Asia where we really can't go in and buy individual shares because of capital controls that exist. So I really like Taiwan. I think there's a lot of opportunity there. But unfortunately, it's difficult for us to trade the Taiwanese shares, you know, for regular individual American investment. But, you know, I'm very bullish on everybody that's involved with China, you know. But we're focusing our attention on Hong Kong.
I remember when I was very young, I used to read about the mainland Chinese were shelling Taiwan. But The guy I've been talking to says they've got a lot of economic ties now.
Oh, sure. They've got tremendous ties. And I've always joked that, you know, that Taiwan has more to fear from the United States than they do from Beijing. You know, I mean, the worst...
That's what I was asking.
The worst thing that could happen to Taiwan wouldn't be China invading. It would be the United States invading them. You know, imagine if we imposed their income tax on them, you know. I mean, the Chinese seem to be much more friendly to freedom and capital than the U.S. government.
Yeah, I think so.
So there's a lot of opportunity there, you know, but unfortunately, you know, we're mainly just buying these Chinese shares because they're the easiest ones to access for, you know, individual investors.
Yep, well, I was just wondering what you thought, and I really don't know.
Are you a client, Ken?
Political things or how you compare a currency, but I was wondering about the strength of the Taiwanese currency.
Oh, it's strong, and it would be a lot stronger if they weren't, you know, weren't trying to suppress it.
So it's going to go along with
Chinese. Are you a client of ours?
I am. I got some gold in the Perth Mint program anyway.
Oh, good. Have you read my book?
I haven't read your book.
Did you know I wrote one?
Yes, I did.
Why aren't you buying it?
I don't know.
Pick up a copy and read.
No, it's my list of to-dos, but I haven't done it.
Yeah, Crash Proof, How to Profit from the Coming Economic Collapse.
I know the title.
And you get on my well, somebody listening might not. So you get it on my website or at a bookstore.
Well,
you know, no one has still reviewed that book. You know, maybe if people are listening too, one of the things you can do is call some newspapers and say, hey, why don't you review Crash Proof? I'm wanting somebody to call too if anybody has done what I asked. And that calling some popular, you know, mainstream talk shows and introducing the subject of my book on the air. That's another thing. I'd love to see this thing reviewed. You know, even Barron's, another book came out.
I'm not going to be able to give it a national review, but when I get around to reading it, which is on my list of things to do, I'm going to call up and harass my local financial talk show host about reading it because he's very full of himself. And but I'll get to it. I just don't do everything I should do.
Yeah, all right. Well, thanks for the call, Ken.
Yeah, well, thanks for your take on Taiwan. I appreciate it.
Yeah, you know, I said this other book that came out, America's Bubble Economy, Profit When It Pops, was talking about some of these same issues as me, and I read through the book. It's not nearly as good a book as mine, if I don't mind saying so. But that book, you know, within a few weeks of coming out, Barron's did a write-up on it. I don't know how many sales it helped them generate, but Barron's, you know, did his two paragraphs, you know, towards the front of the magazine on that book and its thesis. Yet they haven't written one word about my book. And my book has already sold a lot more copies on its own than the American Bubble's Economy, and it's a better book. Anyway, Joel is on the line from Florida. Go ahead, Joel.
Yeah, how
Joe, rather, from Florida. You there?
Hi.
Is Joe there?
Joe, yeah, I'm here.
Hey, Joe, go ahead. It's Peter Schiff.
How you doing? I read your book. Passed it on to my dad. Passed it on to a good friend of mine recently. Anyway, I was really interested in one of the suggestions you had in the book regarding borrowing against real estate and then investing it. I got a vacant piece of land, and one of the local banks recently told me they'd lend me up to 90% of the appraised value, which, you know, basically is about $100,000. So I was thinking about using it to invest. I'm not a client, but I'm considering becoming.
I mean, my feeling on real estate, I mean, I thought that real estate prices would collapse and that it would be very difficult for many people to actually sell their real estate. But
well, I've been trying to sell it, and I'm not getting any bites. But the thing is, I'm still able to borrow against it. And
but that's how crazy this is. I mean, the banks don't even realize that, you know, they're willing to lend you 90% of what the appraised value is. But if you put it on the, but you probably can't even get 80 or 70% of the appraised value if you try to sell it.
I can. I've been running ads in the local Penny Saver, and I'm not even getting any.
Yeah, I've even seen that. I've talked to people where they have their house on the market. Let's say they're trying to, I don't really know what the numbers are for sure, but let's say they're trying to sell their house for $300,000 for 6 months, and no one will buy it. Yet they can go to a bank and borrow $400,000 against it.
Well, anyway, I had two questions regarding that for you. This local bank told me they'd lend me $100,000 at at 15 years, 7% interest. Then the payment comes to about $1,000, you know, a month. And I wanted to ask you, you know, supposing I sent you that money, first question is, you know, how much risk is there, you know, for that to just get completely wiped out, you know, if I do.
Well, we're not going to, okay, first of all, you got to talk to a representative and let them know, hey, I'm borrowing this money, you know, so we know it's borrowed money. But the thing is, if you want to lock in a rate, right, you want to lock in a fixed rate for as long as you can.
Yeah, I'm able to do that.
And what rate will they lend you at?
7% for 15 years.
All right, 7%. All right, so we could probably, I mean, get a dividend yield that will be 7% or maybe 7.5% or something with the money. So the thing is, as long as the dividend is covering the interest payment.
That's what I was going to ask.
It doesn't cost you anything.
All right. So the dividends you think would be enough to cover up?
Yeah, you know, it's not going to be a big positive carry. So you're really not doing it for the carry. You're not really going to be putting a lot of cash in your pocket when you're borrowing at 7 and investing at about the same amount. But what you're trying to do is if the dollar collapses, then the value of that, you know, that $100,000 could turn into $200,000 or $300,000, and which means you could pay off the loan and have the rest of the account, you know, for free.
That makes perfect sense.
And the other problem is, let's say the real estate, you know, you walk away from the real estate, you know, is it recourse? I mean, that's one of the things you want to find out is, you know, can the bank go to your stock portfolio and say, you know what? You borrowed $100,000 against this property. You didn't pay. We sold the property. We only got $50,000. Can they attach your other assets, or do they have to eat it, you know?
That's a good question.
because obviously, if that's the case, then it's like, you know, you borrow their money and you buy some stocks and just hand them the bank, hand them the land, and say, take it.
Yeah, just hand them the keys to the gate and say.
Yeah, a lot of it is their own. These banks are stupid for lending you money that really exceeds the value of the house, because what they're doing is they're accepting these bogus appraisals. You know, but the appraisals are false. They don't mean anything because they don't reflect what you can actually sell the house for. They reflect what somebody was able to sell a house for, you know, a year or two ago.
And it's not even a house. It's just a vacant piece of land.
Oh, whatever. But in general, I mean, most people. But it's like, let's say I have some shares of Yahoo in 2002. And, you know, they're selling for $20, but someone appraises them at $200 because that's what they traded for a couple of years ago. You know, if you can appraise them, it doesn't mean anything. I can't sell them there.
Right.
But these are obviously, there's always, whenever you're borrowing money to invest, I mean, there's risk. But, you know, people borrow to do a lot stupider things than invest. I mean, people borrow to buy cars. People borrow to buy television sets. They borrow to take vacations. I mean, when you do that, you got nothing. I mean, nothing that we would buy you with borrowed money is going to go to zero, like a vacation. Someone borrows $5,000 on their credit card to take a vacation. When the vacation is over, they've got nothing. They don't have they have a memory, but they don't have an asset. You know, nothing that we're going to buy is going to go to zero. I mean, it could go down, but it won't go to nothing. So it's not like borrowing to consume. So borrowing to invest is always better than borrowing to consume. But what you don't want to do is borrow to speculate. And so you don't want to borrow money and just buy some NASDAQ stock because you think it's going to go up. You got to get a yield. You got to borrow to get a real investment. And you don't want to have to, you know, make the interest payment. So if you can at least cover your interest so that you're not negative, then you can decide, well, where would you rather have money? Do you want to have money in U.S. raw land or some foreign stocks? You know, where are you going to be better off? But, you know, the law, the risk is, you know, you send us some money, we buy you some foreign stocks. Let's say you borrow $100,000, you buy some stocks with us. Let's say they go down, you decide to sell, you only get $80,000. Well, now you only got $80,000. You borrowed $100,000. You can pay back $100,000, but now you owe $20,000 because you lost it in the stock market, you know. So those are the risks. You know, you weigh the risk reward, and you decide what you want to do.
The worst comes to worst. I just keep making that payment, and
you borrow. I mean, like, people borrow money against their houses or land to do all sorts of things. They borrow to remodel their kitchen. They got to pay it back. You know, so you know what makes more sense: borrowing to buy a refrigerator or borrowing to buy, you know, a utility in Switzerland. You know,
sure.
I'd rather buy the asset. I mean, I don't borrow. Personally, I don't borrow to consume. If I can't afford it, I don't buy it. right? So I would never borrow money to spend it on a consumer good. But I would borrow money to invest. It makes sense to borrow to invest if you can earn more
and I'm just,
than the cost of the money.
And like you said in your book, I'm just a little concerned that if I don't do it, I'm not going to be able to borrow 100 grand in a year from now.
Oh, at some point, these guys are going to wake up and they'll say, there's no way. I mean, right now, I think a lot of these banks are going to go broke. I mean, there's a lot of people that have lines of credit, let's say in California through Wells Fargo, where, you know, they have a line of credit. Let's say they have a house and they can borrow $900,000 against it, you know, and all of a sudden the house is only worth $400,000 or $300,000, but that line of credit is still there. I bet a lot of people are going to run to the bank knowing that their houses are worth half of their line of credit and just borrow all the money.
Why not?
Well, the bank is stuck.
Why not?
You know, I mean, just the minute that you get the money, then the bank's got to track you down and find it. But once it's in your hands and you start spending it and doing things with it, you know, the bank is going to have to track you down and try to get it back. Of course, if you spend it, they can't get it.
All right, well, I've been passing your book around.
All right, well, you know, make them buy their own copies.
I'll tell them.
I want to generate these sales out there, not because I need the money. I hardly make any money when these books are sold. I just want them out. I want to see books sell so that maybe something will happen. I mean, maybe if this thing can become a bestseller, somebody might actually review it. You know, it's like, I'm like, my book is like Ron Paul. You know, he's running for president. No one knows about it because no one pays any attention. Well, I wrote a book.
Unless
it's a pretty good one, but people don't know about it because nobody will review it.
Right.
All right.
Oh, thanks for your advice.
Thanks for the call.
Okay. Good evening. Bye.
And I think now we're back down in Florida again with Joe. Or was that just Joe?
That was Joe. And I'm Steven in California.
Steve in California. Okay, Steve, go ahead.
Hi, Peter. Just following what he said, I'm reading some blogs on the internet out here, and there was a basket of foreclosure auctions in San Diego last
week. Oh, I read about that. You know, let's talk about that, but I forgot. Let's pause 1 minute. I forgot about my second break.
All right.
Let's take the second commercial and we'll talk about those foreclosures as soon as we're in 1 minute. Usually they listen to me, and if I say play the commercial, they play it.
Euro Pacific Capital is an independent brokerage firm on a mission to inform its client base and prospective clients about economic and market events that could affect their financial security. Euro Pacific Capital seeks to provide solutions which are intended to provide safety, not risk. Solutions designed to protect our clients and their families from the U.S. government and its inflationary practices. The time to act is now, while you still have the opportunity to get your money out of the dollar. It's legal to do so, and after a consultation with one of Euro Pacific's brokers, you will understand how this decision could ensure your financial security. We offer a full array of services ranging from retirement and trust accounts to complete financial planning, checking accounts with or without debit cards, and life insurance, even annuities. With our independent, no-nonsense investment advice that's a cut above the run-of-the-mill commentary that is passed for research for far too long on Wall Street, we suspect investors will find a home at Euro Pacific Capital.
We are back, and I've got Steve on the line from California. We're going to talk about those foreclosure auctions that took place in San Diego recently.
Right, and evidently they went for as low as half of their appraised value. It was something like
they went from anywhere from 30% to 50% below appraised value. So the highest sale was 30% below the appraised
value. Right, which is an incredible drop. And it just goes to, you know, kind of confirm what you were saying about these, you know, it can look like the market's still going up because so few things are selling, and they're selling on the high end. And now that they're trying to dump these foreclosures, I think we're going to start seeing a real, you know, some real numbers start piling up out here. And the other thing that I also read...
Do they exclude the foreclosures from the statistics?
Well, you know, I haven't been able to find that out, and I wonder if they are. I wonder if...
So when I was in Las Vegas to the Money Show, I was talking to a realtor, and he was telling me that, you know, about 15% or so of the supply right now in Las Vegas is banks, you know, selling properties. But they're not selling them through foreclosure because they realize they can't sell them that way. So they're getting realtors, and they're listing the properties. Because if they put them in the foreclosure process, they would get so little that they don't even want to do it. So they're not foreclosing. They're taking the property from the owner, but they're just listing it with a realtor and waiting patiently to try to get a sale.
And some of the housing, you know, real estate blogger guys say that this is the initial step in this process, and they think they're just going to hold on until it gets better. If it doesn't, they will eventually dump these into foreclosure. But we're just...
I mean, that's people's hope. They just think if they wait it out, you know, that the market's going to improve. Everybody's looking for the market to improve. But you know, why? Why would it improve? It's only going to get worse.
Well,
I mean, it's just
how
more inventory.
I want to fold that into your comment about when will the central banks do the right thing and raise interest rates. Because when we look at this situation here, and they're holding on for things to get better, well, if the interest rates go up, it's going in the opposite direction.
Right, and interest rates are rising. I mean, the yield on the 30-year bond is now above 5% for the first time in a couple of months. And if you look at a chart of the 10-year and the 30-year, rates have really been on a tear. They've been going up every day for the past month or so.
But that's independent of the Fed. I mean, people don't want a loan now.
Yeah, I think you're going to see, I think by the end of the year, the yield on the 10-year is going to be, you know, 5.25, 5.5 at a minimum. And I think by next year, you know, we're going to be, you know, 6.75, 7% or more on the 10-year. And what's that going to mean when these adjustable rate mortgages are resetting? You know,
there's $1 trillion in these ARMs. Just in the U.S. over the next 5 years that have to reset.
About a trillion over the next year. For the next 5 years, it's even more.
Oh. I mean, it
yeah.
So I'm trying to see. It may not even matter if the Fed, I mean, let's say Bernanke, I mean, I thought his thinking is that to never do anything like the 1929 and the 30s, meaning don't raise the rates, lower rates, if it looks like you're...
That means you get a greater disaster. You get hyperinflation.
Well, correct.
So,
they seem to want the hyperinflation over the deflation.
Yeah, but hyperinflation is worse. So, you know, everything that this man believes is wrong, you know, whether he's actually going to do it or not. But, you know, going back to these appraisals, it shows you that, you know, when are the appraisals going to start to come, you know, to be more realistic? And if, you know, if when you foreclose something, if you're letting people buy property with nothing down, right, or 5 or 10% down. And if you foreclose it, you know you're going to get 30 to 50% less than the appraised value. It's a guaranteed loser. So, I mean, banks have to look at what a property is worth in foreclosure. That was the whole idea behind the 20% down payment. It was like, well, if the guy doesn't pay and we have to sell this thing in foreclosure, then we'll probably at least get 80% of the value. And we've already got 20, so we're okay. Because banks knew, okay, if I have to sell this thing in foreclosure right away, I'm not going to get the best price. I'm going to get some kind of discount, but not a 50% discount. And certainly, if you're letting people buy with zero down, so banks are going to have to say, okay, if you're going to buy with, you know, zero down, and yeah, we're not going to lend you $500,000 to buy this house, anymore. We're going to lend you $300,000. The banks are going to have to, or the lenders are going to have to start to, you know.
Well, it's going to go down either way. And you know, they can hold on to it forever, but then that'll start reflecting in the lower sales, which is already being reflected. So,
yeah, I mean, for homes are going to sell. And what's going to happen is more and more homes are going to are on the market. And eventually what's going to happen is, sure, people will start removing their homes from the market because they're discouraged, they're not selling them. But all of a sudden, when fewer and fewer houses are selling, now all of a sudden you've got 2 years supply on the market, 3 years supply. Because, you know, and the fact that they're not selling is directly a function of the fact that the prices are too high. That's why they're not selling.
Of course. I mean, they could only sell with the loans that were structured. So that
was the only reason that the houses could be sold for these crazy prices was because there were crazy loans.
Peter, you have shacks in the middle of L.A. selling for $500,000. I mean, that's not, there's no value there at all. I mean, it's absurd. And
the reason they were selling for that much is because the person buying them thought a year from now it would be worth $600,000, and they can borrow the $500,000 with nothing down with an adjustable rate negative AM loan.
What?
So it was like It was a free way to make $100,000.
Well, I think that's what you call a...
You know, and I mentioned on this show, but when I looked at these condos that were right next door to an apartment that I was renting in Stanford, and I was renting a much nicer apartment than these condos, but the condos were so expensive, you know, and nowhere near as nice. They didn't have the amenities. I mean, and the realtor said, well, I said, why should I live in this dumpy condo when for a lot less money... you know, I can just rent a much nicer apartment next door, right?
Right.
And her response is, well, when you move out of your apartment, you're not going to have any equity.
But
the assumption was that real estate always appreciates. And so, yes, the apartments are nicer and they cost less money. But if you just buy this dump and live in it for a while, you'll get rich. So people were willing to buy a shack because that shack was going to make them rich.
Well, that's over, I think.
Oh, yeah, well, now it is. It's obviously, it ended the market peak a couple of years ago, and I know from personal experience, and I've got thousands of clients. I have conversations with people all over the country every day who are trying to sell houses, who have been trying to sell houses for 6 months to a year at prices 20 or 30% below what similar houses sold for 2 years ago, and they still can't find buyers.
Mm-hmm, that's right. Same for mine.
And people will say, oh, and then you look at the statistics, and they show prices still went up in the last year.
No,
it's ridiculous.
If I can...
It's like they just had someone in New York just bought an apartment, you know, for $55 million, you know. So one of these crazy high-end, you know, homes, those type of transactions probably skew up the whole thing.
Well, somebody bought a $103 million house in the Hamptons, and that was all over the papers as if the bottom of actually, there was a headline on Bloomberg or something. Talked about selling his $103 million house, it said it proved the resilience of the housing market.
It just proved that some idiot with a lot of money was willing to buy a house in the Hamptons. I mean, I'm sure the guy that bought that is some hedge fund manager.
It is a hedge fund manager.
Yeah, and he probably earns, and I have the word earns in parentheses, but he probably earns, you know, a few hundred million to $1 billion a year, and so what does he care?
Yeah, I mean, it was a minor transaction for him. But if I can go, because I know time's running, a real quick client question. I'm working with Newport Beach, and in the portfolio, there's lots of good natural resource stocks, but there's no gold plays. And I'm wondering whether you could maybe put together some sort of short list of a basket of gold miners.
Well, we have a lot of gold mining stocks that we recommend. And just talk to the broker that you're dealing with. They know the stocks that we like.
Okay, that's fine then.
There's Canadian stocks, and there's Australian stocks. And, yeah, I mean, our typical portfolio is going to be more of a yield-oriented portfolio. And, you know, there's no yield in the mining stocks, the gold stocks. And so if you want to have a percentage of gold, just let us know. See, a lot of our clients, too, that come to us already have gold stocks at other brokers. They already bought them. You know, there's...
Well, I bought some precious metal stocks, but I want to sell them because they're in dollars. And...
Well, no, they're not in dollars. They're precious metal stocks. It doesn't matter what price they're in. They sell gold. But I think there's better valuations if you know, in some of the foreign stocks, some of the Canadians and the Australians, than some of the ones that you might see listed on the, you know, New York Stock Exchange or the Amex. But when you own a gold company, you know, the thing that's going to determine its value is not what exchange it trades on. It's just the price of gold. Because whether you're an American gold company or a South African or an Australian, you're selling gold on the international market, and that's what you're getting. It doesn't matter that your shares are listed. You know, in fact, most companies, a lot of companies, you know, Newmont Mining, you know, is listed in the United States, but, you know, it's listed in Australia. I think it's listed in Europe somewhere. I mean, you know, these stocks trade on other exchanges. And it doesn't, if you own the shares in one exchange or another, there's not going to be any difference. The reason that we like to buy foreign stocks, let's say for a REIT or a utility, is because they collect their rents or their bills. They bill their, in euros or in Australian dollars. So we want to own it. It's based on what their income is in. But if you own a gold stock, their income is selling gold bullion.
Well, that's true. And
it doesn't matter what the dollar does.
So it's going to be the same sort of percentage in any currency is what you're saying.
Yeah, you're going to get the same gain. Like, well, obviously, gold might not go up as much in terms of euros as it does in terms of dollars. So if you owned a gold stock in Europe, it might go up less than a gold stock in America, but it would still go up the same amount when you take a currency into effect.
I see. I think I misunderstood how that works.
It actually works a little better. Like if you're a gold miner and you're in a country like the U.S. where the dollar loses value, you know, your cost of mining goes down a little bit because you can, you know, you pay your work.
If your mine is in the United States, yes.
Yeah. So sometimes it's good to invest in mining companies where, you know, the currency is weak, because that means the gold is even stronger in that local economy.
I do follow.
Relative to the cost of mining.
I do follow that. Thanks. Okay. Well, thanks for your time today. Enjoyed talking with you.
Great. Have you read the book?
Oh, I've read the book, and I'm a client, so.
Okay, good.
All that good stuff.
All right. Thanks for the call.
Bye-bye.
You know, everybody, I mentioned this book. I mean, the book, you know, it took a long time to write it, so I definitely want to make sure everybody reads it. But it really does a good job of, you know, putting all these points that I make, putting them in one location, in one book, and doing it in kind of an organized fashion. And it's good. You know, people are commenting that they give the book to a friend or they tell friends about it. And it's a great way to try to introduce other people into these ideas and these concepts and get them to understand exactly what we're in for as a society. And also so they can do something about it before it's too late. And, you know, I don't know how much more time we have. That's always a question that I can't answer. And a lot of people who have been talking about these problems have discredited themselves by trying to come up with a timetable, like it's going to fall apart by then. Because then if it doesn't happen, then they go back and say, you see, you were wrong. I don't know when everything's going to fall apart. I just know that it's going to. And so in the meantime, we have to be prepared for it. But we can prepare in a way that even if we're still early, even if we're years early. Like I said, I was talking to people 7 years ago, 8 years ago about these problems and the fact that it was going to one day lead to disaster. Now it's been 7 years, 8 years, it hasn't happened. But anybody who followed my advice 7 or 8 years ago and invested in a portfolio that was based on this gloomy outlook, they're in much better shape. They've enjoyed much better returns than someone who said, Peter, you don't know what you're talking about. That's nonsense. There's nothing wrong. I'm just going to keep all my money invested in the U.S. stock market. Even though that person was right in that we haven't had the catastrophe yet, they were wrong in that they have worse returns. And I don't see anything to make me feel that if for some crazy reason the world decides to support us for another 6 or 7 years, and we accumulate another $5 or $10 trillion in debt during that time, if it's even possible that we can go that deep into debt, I don't see any reason to believe that during that time period, U.S. stocks are going to perform better than foreign stocks, that the U.S. dollar is going to rise, even as our trade deficit goes from $60 billion a month to $100 billion a month. I mean, if it's possible. And because remember, in order for this bubble economy to continue, it has to get bigger, right? It can't stop. We have to keep borrowing more and more. We have to keep consuming more and more. We have to keep going into debt, because the minute we start paying anything off and stop consuming is when the recession hits. So in order to postpone it, we have to keep making these problems worse. We have to keep increasing the trade deficit, reducing our savings rate, printing more money, exporting more manufacturing jobs. This whole thing has to continue. We have to blow. We have to create it. We have to dig ourselves into a deeper and deeper hole in order to stop the music or stop us from having to face the music. So if we can do that for several more years, it's going to be that much worse, right, in the end. But it doesn't mean that we don't want to adopt these strategies, because they should continue to pay off better than a domestic portfolio. But I have a feeling, and I've said before, that we are running out of time. And I'm actually running out of time on the show. We got about a minute left. So thanks, everybody, for listening. Again, remember, read the book, Crash Proof. The newsletter, people have been bugging me. I know I'm behind. Within another week or two, I promise, the next issue of the newsletter will be out. If you haven't gotten the newsletter in the last few months, make sure that you whitelist us so you don't. We do mass mail this thing, and you don't want to have it go into your spam filter or something. So make sure that you're set up for your Pacific Capital emails to come through. Visit the website at www.europac.net and call us toll free at 800-727-777. 7922. Don't forget to watch me a week from Friday on CNBC, Kudlow and Company. Not sure where in the hour I will be on, but I will be on. Thanks for listening, and I will be here again talking to you live next week, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Thanks for listening. So long.